We're starting.
Okay.
Because this is fascinating. We're not going to do the set thing. We'll talk for a while.
Yeah, but I want you to know all that background.
Yeah,
because
yeah, yeah.
I had a lot of people helping me, but no one to guide me in my mm-hmm. personal life.
Let's get started. Mark Pettit, the author of Anchor Boy, A-N-K-R-B-O-Y, which is available now at Amazon.com. Where else can people get that?
You can get an autographed copy at anchorboy.com, www.anchorboy.com. I pack and ship them myself.
You do. You do everything. you do fulfillment. You follow up, make sure they got it and everything. No, your publicist, it is strange how this interview came about. A publicist just sent me an email.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, I looked into it. I said, yeah, this is interesting. And I don't know, were we following each other already on Facebook, or were you following me? Or?
I was following you.
Okay.
Because I'm a fan of what you do.
Thank you.
I love all the voices you do. I listen to Eric Von Hessler. So I've been a fanboy of yours for a while, I guess.
Isn't that weird? I'm about to interview, after you, I'm interviewing one of my radio heroes, and I've just been nervous. But I've decided I've just got to do it. You just got to do it.
Just have a conversation with him.
Exactly.
You know?
Yes.
He came from where you and I came from. Mm-hmm. You know, he was probably scared when he started, and somebody helped him, and now it's full circle.
Yep. Now he runs his own digital empire. But we're going to talk about you, and we're going to talk about the book, and we're going to talk about what you do for a living. And there's a lot to unpack. Let's back up. You are from Calhoun, Georgia.
Calhoun, Georgia.
So did you work in a carpet factory or there?
Ironically, my parents did.
Your parents did?
Yes. And back in the day, it was a poor man's take your kid to work. Mm-hmm. And my mother mended carpets.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever seen this, Tim, but mm-mm. She had this long gun and the carpets would come off. And whenever there was an error or a mistake, she would lift this gun and repair it.
Okay. And the gun had the filament or whatever.
Yeah. It was excruciatingly hard work. And she was a small woman, mm-hmm. you know, and she took me to work with her. And I tried to do that. And I was like, I got to get out of here. I got to get an education.
Right.
And so that's what propelled me. But since I was a little boy, I wanted to be an anchorman.
How did you know? What made you want to be an anchor boy?
I just loved
an anchorman.
I loved Walter Cronkite. I loved Dan Rather. I loved all the guys. I would flip from station to station when there were only three
mm-hmm.
and watch the evening news and try to – I wanted to be that.
How old were you then?
I was probably 8 or 9 years old when I knew that I wanted to be an anchorman.
Isn't that strange that – we sort of have a parallel thing because at 8, 9 years old, any normal kid is not sitting down to watch the news. I did the same thing. My grandparents would watch the local news in Elmira, New York, which is where I grew up in that market. And then afterwards, it was the nightly news. And it was always Rather. Yeah. And I forget who did it at night. But then you had in the morning, my mom would get up and watch Good Morning America with David Hartman.
Yes.
David Hartman.
I remember.
Ramona Barrett doing the gossip. I ate that stuff up.
Yeah.
So I think we're in a similar
boat. Absolutely.
Similar
and
boat.
I think my friends thought I was a nerd. They were like, why are you watching this? And I said, because I want to be that someday.
Yeah.
And I would watch Channel 11. I dreamed about it. I wanted to be on Channel 11 when I was a young boy.
And was it an NBC affiliate then too?
Yes, it was an NBC affiliate.
All right. And so back then you had WAGA was CBS, WSB was ABC, and then 11 was...
Right.
Yeah.
And they'd all flip-flopped
a
couple times,
okay.
right?
Okay. Yeah, because now Fox is... WAGA
Five
is Fox
now.
Yes. And I should know that because that's where my wife works. growing up and seeing these people. Now, I also had the same thing. Did you listen to radio a lot?
I loved it, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Paul Harvey.
Yep.
Love Paul Harvey. So I've always been a fan of broadcast news,
mm-hmm.
radio, TV. You know, I did fill-in work at GST, and I know you were there as well. I was at the station when Sean Hannity was there, Tom Howell.
Sean Hannity worked there then?
Sean Hannity, yeah.
Sean Hannity was very young back then. He had.
If I have to stay on hold one more time, I'll lose it.
Yes, right. That's a good Hannity impression. But let me tell you, anyway, Linda,
yeah, I was hoping this is where this would go, Tim.
Good. Okay? Well, I'll just talk like Sean Hannity the whole time. But there's a clip of him. I was watching a documentary over the weekend, and there was a clip of him with the WGST mic. And I knew he was there, but I'd never seen him there. You know, because back then, he wasn't on TV, right? He was yet to be on Fox News, yet to be in New York City on the air. He's not a local guy, right?
I think he came from Alabama.
Came from Alabama, okay.
Eric recruited him.
Eric?
Eric from WGST.
Okay. Don't remember who that would be.
I'll come back to that in a moment.
All right. But recruited him to come there.
Yes. He was at a small station in Alabama. I'm almost positive.
And GST used to be a dual
Eric
signal.
Seidel.
Eric Seidel. I know that name.
Hello,
yeah.
Eric.
Hello, Eric Seidel. Yeah. WGST used to be on 640 and then 105.7 FM. And in the 2000s, radio went under a whole bunch of changes and a lot of consolidation that happened prior to that. They just made it garbage. A lot of things,
But this was when Steve Holman was there, you remember?
Yeah, I do.
Tom Hughes.
Yeah, Tom Hughes. Brought Tom Hughes back to try to save them.
Yes.
But when they got rid of the FM signal, a lot of it just went away. The ratings went away and it never repaired itself. But you grew up, I mean, those were the people you were listening to.
Yep.
And when did you, I was reading the first chapter of the book, the second chapter of the book, is that you decided to go to college.
And, yeah, I went to Shorter College up in Rome, Georgia on a baseball scholarship. My scholarship was $800 a year back then.
Did it pay for the entire thing back then?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
How cool was that, though?
That
but
awesome.
I had a part-time job. I washed our uniforms. That was my job.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to know the coach, Hamp Alexander. And sadly, near the end of the season, I tore my rotator cuff.
And you were what, a pitcher?
Yeah. I was a relief pitcher, played second base. And so I threw a lot of junk. I could throw curveballs, sliders, knuckleballs even. I used to love Phil Niekro, and I learned how to throw a knuckleball.
Mm-hmm.
And one day during practice, I threw a lot of live batting practice, and I just felt something snap in my arm. And Hamp took me to the specialist, and he said, "Coach, he needs surgery. He's torn his rotator cuff." And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I knew it was over.
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, I'm going to be a TV newscaster."
And that's you just made that decision.
And I started working for a radio station in Rome, Georgia. And there was a local fireman. He said, "If you want to be on TV, we need to record this." So I would take my radio scripts, stand out in the backyard of the station, and read into the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent my tapes to a TV station in Omaha. In Chattanooga, because we could watch Chattanooga TV and Atlanta TV. I knew I was not good enough to be on Atlanta, but I thought maybe I can get on TV in Chattanooga. And there was a radio guy up there who became the news director, and I hounded him.
Yeah.
I sent him this tape. I called him, and finally he called me back. And he said, "Okay, look, just come up. I'll take you to lunch, and we'll talk about it." And we hit it off immediately, and he offered me a job at the TV station. I didn't even ask what my salary was. I was so excited. You know how it is.
Yeah, yeah.
You do it for free.
I've done that before, too. It's like when I was working at an ad agency doing television commercials for radio stations coast to coast, making a pretty good salary, getting commissions on the sales I would make because it was a mom-and-pop business in a basement off of Mount Perrin in Sandy Springs. And I did a commercial for 96 Rock, and it was just a syndicated one. And the program director called me and said, "Hey, let's get lunch." And so long story short, I ended up taking a job in promotions just because I wanted to get in the building because I knew what I had inside of me, and I wanted to find an outlet for it. And I took a $15,000 pay cut. And,
oh, my God.
And because that's always my whole life was radio. I've done the disc jockey thing. Wasn't really my cup of tea, especially when I found out you don't get to pick the music. And I sort of just, floated around in the air. So similar sort of thing.
So my salary was $12,500.
That's big money back in when?
1989.
Okay.
So that would be about 40 grand today, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If you Google that.
But more important, what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I got in the door, and that's all I needed. Once I got in, I started breaking stories left and right.
Nice.
You know, and Earl was like, "I'm glad I took a chance on you, son." And out of the blue, like a year and a half into my job, I get a call from Omaha, Nebraska, a TV station in Omaha, Nebraska, and I'm like, "What is this?"
Pre-web, how did people find out about you?
I didn't know. I thought cows ran in the streets of Omaha because I grew up watching Wild Kingdom.
Uh-huh.
You remember?
Yeah, of course.
Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
What was that guy's name?
Marlon Perkins.
Marlon Perkins, and he had that assistant who did all the work?
Loved it.
Yeah.
Jim will now wrestle the anaconda.
That's right.
You know? So that's all I knew about Omaha. And I get this call, and I call this lady named Carol. She was the news director at the station in Omaha. And she said, "Hey, would you just come out and talk to us? We'll fly you out." And I thought, you know, I'd never been on an airplane. I'll fly to Omaha, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I expected cows to be running down the street. I get there, and the place is beautiful.
Yeah, Omaha's a nice city.
Yeah. And I meet Carol. She takes me to the Omaha Press Club. And this is all in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, here I am 21. And she invites me to the Omaha Press Club. We walk in, and it's this panoramic view. And there are all these famous newscasters on the wall. Tom Brokaw worked at the station. And so she has me up there. And at the near the end of the dinner, I said, "Carol, you know, this is all great, but how did you find me? I'm in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And she said, oh, it's the news director over at the competition. He's been sending me your tapes for months.
To get rid of you out
of
the bar. You're too good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was kicking their butt, you know, doing investigative reporting, anchoring the new news, you know, and I ran the teleprompter with my foot like they all have to run it now back then.
Oh, they had that little thing on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so she says, yeah, Dave over at the competition's been sending me your tapes. And so I've created in the book, I use that story to kind of propel the book forward. But that's how she recruits me to Omaha. She hires me on the spot. And I didn't know anybody. I didn't know a soul in Omaha, Nebraska. And I poured myself into the work and it just took off.
You say in I think it's the preface that or maybe I read it someplace. I don't know, but there's some fictionalized.
Yes, it's called a fictionalized memoir.
Okay.
And I have an editor. His name is David Baklaski. David's actually in England. He's an American living in England. And I'll tell you, I've written two books that have become bestsellers. And the first one was by complete accident. I had no idea what I was doing, but it was about a serial child killer that I formed a relationship with. That book went to number one. This one was different because I've had this on my mind that I've been wanting to write this book, Anchor Boy, for a long time, but I knew I needed an editor. And so I did some research and put a query out through this editor's association and narrowed it down to two guys. One was a guy named Ian in Los Angeles, and he and his wife produce movies. And I thought, well, he'll get this because I want this to become a movie. And I send Ian the idea. I send him a couple of chapters. He picks up the phone and calls me and says, what are you thinking? You don't need a writer. I thought I needed a ghostwriter.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm too busy to write this book. And he said, nobody can write this book like you. You need to sit down and bang this out. Just whatever time you have at night, in between your regular job. And David in England said the same thing. And then Ian got busy and couldn't work with me. And David said, I'll help you. I'll be your editor. So having an editor is very important when you're writing a book, because he pushed me. What did it smell like? What were you thinking? You know, he would push me in ways that I wasn't quite thinking about, and the book got better and better as I went because I had that guidance helping me. But that's how it all came about, is that we originally wrote the screenplay for this to be a movie. I have a co-writer named A.J. Jones, and A.J.'s a great writer. So he and I spent about 4 months writing the script for the movie. We got it finished, and I was like, okay, I think I can make this for about $1 million. I was going to raise the money. And I had a friend who's a line producer. He was going to do the breakdown and tell me what the budget would be. And he wrote me back. He said, are you crazy? This is at least $3 to $5 million.
Oh,
and I was
man.
Like, oh, my God, I can't raise that kind of money. So I said, you know what? I got to get this off my chest. I'm just going to write the book. And that's what I did. I sat down night after night after night, weekend on end, just told my friends, I'm out. I've got to write this book. And that's what happened.
Hmm.
And
how long did it take you to complete it?
It took me about 4 months
okay.
to get the first draft down. And Tim, it's wild. I tell people, it started as 2,000 words, then it became 20, then it was 40. Next thing I knew, I was at 95,000. And it was almost like a gift. It was like I cut my wrist and my life poured onto the screen. There's some really sad stuff in the book. And there were nights I was doubled over bawling in front of my computer.
Those memories.
Yes.
The memories you have.
Because it was like it was all coming back.
Yeah.
And but I swear this is a gift, I think, from God to me, because it just flew out of me. And David was reading as we were going, and he goes, man, this is good. You've got this something here. And I said, I think so too. And I wrote every word myself, and then David helped me what they call season and mm-hmm. you know, so forth. And then I used this program, an AI software, to scan the book. And I'm not joking. It took me 4.5 months to write it. It took the program about 4.5 minutes, and it said, this book will be a bestseller.
Really?
Yes. It is
just
engaging.
Based on all the algorithms and data.
It is engaging from the start. There is nowhere the reader will not be engaged in the story.
You get pulled right into the book, by the way. I read the first chapter, and we'll talk about that in a second.
All right.
So let's pick back up in Omaha. So you go to Omaha.
Yep.
You're an investigative reporter.
Yep.
And where do you go from Omaha? How long were you there?
Well, I had a horrible secret in Omaha.
What's that?
And I was a gay man.
In Omaha?
Yeah. And I'd been fighting it for a long time. I knew that as well since I was probably a teenager. But I did everything I could. I dated women. I tried to be straight. And I knew that there were no gay...
How do you try to be straight?
I'm from a small town.
Yeah.
I was Mr. Calhoun High School.
Yeah.
Most likely to succeed. President of the student council.
Baseball player.
Baseball player. That's all macho.
Right.
You know? And it's expected of you to have a girlfriend, you know, and I tried. I dated women, I tried, but something was missing. And I go to Omaha, and I meet this young guy who's in med school. He's going to be a doctor, a specialist in infectious diseases, and he becomes like my secret boyfriend
okay.
in Omaha. Totally hidden. He's from Brazil, but training in Omaha at Nebraska Medical Center to be a doctor. And so he and I have this secret relationship that I don't want anybody to know about, and my news director didn't know. And she and I have stayed in touch, and I sent her the book, and I was nervous.
Right.
I thought, oh, God, what's she going to think? And she wrote me back and said, this is incredible. And it's shocking how little we know about people we work with.
Yeah.
You know, your personal life.
Especially when you have to hide things.
Yeah. She said, honestly, I had no clue till you got to Atlanta and when the things unfolded there. And Rock Hudson died. Have you read this story yet? The book.
I haven't gotten that far, no.
So it's
Tell me the year again, though. Tell me the year.
This is October 1985.
Okay.
Rock Hudson suddenly dies. I'm at the station. I'm back in an edit booth working on an investigative piece that I was working on. And the news director comes in. She says, get ready. You're going on air. And I said, what happened? She said, Rock Hudson's died. They say it's gay cancer. And
grid.
Here I am.
Grid.
Yeah.
That's what they called it at first.
Yeah. And here I am, 21 years old. I'm in the closet. And so I pull myself together. They hand me the script. I go out. We're about to go on the air. Now special report in Omaha. Here's Mark Pettit. Just as I come on, the teleprompter goes black. And people freeze in the studio. And they're like, should we abort? And we're about to come on the air, it goes blank. Should we abort? And I said, no. Give me air to camera two. I've got this. So no script, no nothing. Reported Rock Hudson's death. They had a specialist in the studio. It went on for about 15 minutes. And I was just in this zone where I was trying not to think about it. And we wrapped up and people are applauding in the studio. And I was like, whoa. And they said, that was incredible. And Carol comes to me and she said, oh my God, you nailed it. That was very impressive. And so that night, Tim, I go to a sports bar with my clandestine date. We're sitting there, and all of a sudden, all the monitors, the bartender says, stop. Hey, here it is, everybody. And Peter Jennings comes on, and he says, we can now confirm that the legendary actor Rock Hudson died of the mysterious disease AIDS. Went on a few more minutes, and then he said again, the LA coroner's office reports Rock Hudson is dead of AIDS. And the place erupted in applause. This is no joke.
Applauding because he had died of AIDS.
Yes. And there I am, 21 years old, 22, and I'm sitting in this bar, and I'm thinking, if they hate Rock Hudson, they're never going to like me.
Rock Hudson was the epitome of manliness in those movies back when he was making those films.
Yeah, movie star.
Yeah, movie star.
Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah.
And it just forced me deeper into the closet. And this is all in the book, and that was a horrifying experience for me. But
think about it. I got to say this. If you're listening, think about this. This isn't that long ago. It's 40 years ago, give or take.
Yep.
You're thinking, well, you know, I grew up progressive, but then, you know, I'm a Gen Xer. These people that he's talking about in that bar were not Gen Xers. They were boomers and older.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing back then, to cheer the death of somebody because of a disease that wasn't their fault is disgusting. But, I mean, I remember it well. I remember all the jokes.
Yep.
Kids were telling the jokes. I was in high school then.
Yep.
And you didn't even know. You didn't know what you were joking about. You didn't pay attention. So anyway.
So I was shocked. I had this little leather coat that I bought myself in Omaha, and I was so mortified when it happened. I walked out of the bar. And Paolo, you'll read about him in the book. He's with me, and he comes running out, and he says, they didn't mean it. They don't understand what they're laughing. They don't understand it. That's why they're laughing. He said, it's not gay. It's that they don't know how to react, and that's their instinct. But it damaged me.
Yeah.
And so I just poured myself into the work. And that's when I met the killer that's in the book.
Okay.
So there's a young killer in Omaha. I grew up with Wayne Williams,
right.
In Atlanta.
Yeah.
I was obsessed with the Wayne Williams case as a young guy wanting to be a reporter, right? And so the news director says, well, we have our own Wayne Williams. It's a guy in the book. His name is Jeremy Jonas. And she said, he killed two boys here, and there are rumors about others. And so I said, well, I'm going to interview him. And what I didn't know at the time was he was 22 and I was 22. We were born a month apart.
Mm-hmm.
And you see his picture. He's an Eagle Scout. We both, you know, young, handsome young guys.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how did he do this? And how am I here? Could I have been a killer, you know? So I pursue him and start writing him letters. And then he writes me back. And he agrees to meet with me. And so Mark and the killer form this odd bond that we meet eight times on death row. He ends up confessing to a third murder to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell him at that point that I'm going to write the book on his case. And the book, I write it. It comes out. It's a huge hit, and the FBI shows up at the office.
At your house?
Yes.
Or at your office?
At the office.
Why did they go to your office?
We want your files. We want everything, because he had confessed to the third murder in my book. I had not told anybody until the book came out, and they came after me. And we were able to, my agent knew a lawyer, we were able to cut a deal where I would only testify to one comment that he had made to me during the interview, and they convicted him for the third murder.
Wow.
So in the book, that plays a really interesting part, is that the killer comes after me for revenge.
Okay.
So I'm not going to spoil it for you.
Please don't, because I am going to read this book. And also, we're not going to spoil it for you out there. I highly recommend it. And let's, as we say in the business, reset. Mark Pettit, Anchorboy, A-N-K-R-B-O-Y, an interesting tale indeed. So how long were you in Omaha?
I was in Omaha for 4 years.
Okay.
First,
and all this happened?
Yes.
Shortly after you leave Chattanooga.
Yeah, it just all, just I can't explain it. It was meant to be, I guess. But I was the weekend anchor for the first 2 years. And then again, Carol comes to me one day and says, I need to talk to you. And she brings me in the office and I'm like, oh God, what have I done now? Because I was pushing the envelope. One night I did a story where there was a home invasion and the homeowner shot two guys and killed them. So I bring a gun onto camera, you know, and pretend like I'm the homeowner, and the camera guy falls over. You know, I was just too young. I didn't know really what I was doing, mm-hmm. but I wanted to do compelling television, and Carol freaked out. She called me, and I got a scolding for that. So I thought I was in trouble.
Fake news?
Yeah, back then.
Fake news.
Fake. But she said, my anchor man can't be holding a gun on television. That was basically the message.
That makes sense.
That I got.
Yeah.
So she calls me, and I think I'm in trouble, and she says, the main anchor's leaving the station. And she said, we're going to be replacing him. And I said, okay, cool. Do you have candidates? And she said, yeah, we have three. We have a guy from Atlanta, a guy from Cleveland, and you.
Hmm.
And I said, me? 22 years old. I said,
22 being the lead anchor in a market like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
I said, go with the guy from Atlanta. And because I knew who it was.
And who was it?
It was John McKnight.
Okay.
And John, I love John. And John McKnight was up for the job in Omaha, and a guy from Cleveland. And Carol says, well, that's what I thought too until we did the focus groups. And she said, they want you. And I was like, what? She goes, the viewers, your Q rating's through the roof. And I didn't know what a Q rating was. I'm sure your wife does.
Yes, she does.
That's what people like you. They trust you. And
right.
she said it was the Rock Hudson thing. So how ironic is that?
That can't imagine that, the duality that you have to keep in you.
Yeah.
That you have to suppress who you really are
yes.
in order to be what you want to be.
And that's the irony of the whole thing. They were paying me to tell the truth, and I was living this lie, this whole thing. So I get promoted to the main job, and the station gets dropped by NBC. So we get picked up by CBS, and this is in 1986. So Carol says, CBS is flying you to New York. You're going to do promos with Dan Rather.
Wow.
So can you imagine this?
No, I can't. It was 22, 23 years old.
Yeah. So they fly me to New York, and Carol says, I want you to come back with a behind the scenes series on 60 Minutes on CBS. So I get there, and the PR lady meets me in the lobby. And I said, I'm really looking forward to interviewing Mr. Rather. And she said, I'm working on this series. She just said, sorry, sweetheart, that's not going to happen. This is going to be a gripping grin. With Mr. Rather, and I said, a gripping grin. She says, yeah, we're going to pull him out of a meeting. He's going to come over. We're going to snap a couple of photos of you guys shaking hands like you've known each other forever. And again, remember, naivete is a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So Dan Rather comes out. He's much better looking in person. He's just stunning, handsome guy, right? He comes out, and I'm like, he goes, Mark Pettit, right? Omaha, that's an important market for us.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought, does he say this to everybody?
Yes.
And he said, so how's your visit going to CBS News? And I said, not very well.
Oh, you were just frank.
Yeah. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I've got a problem. My news director told me to come up here and do a series of behind-the-scenes report on CBS, and your PR lady told me this is going to be a grip and grin. He said, Mark, I get paid to solve problems. Give me 2 minutes. He took the PR lady, a Tom Batag, who was his executive producer, into the bubble, and I hear voices raised, right?
Yeah, wow.
So he comes back out, and he said, Liz, we're assigning 2 crews to Mark. I want everything lit like it's going to be on the CBS Evening News. He said, walk with me. So he takes me down this hallway, and he pushes open these doors, and it's that two-story blue set. Do you remember this when Dan Rather was doing the news on CBS? It was a two-story studio.
Yeah, yeah.
It was incredible.
Yep.
He said, you're one of the first people outside of the network to see this studio. This is where we're going to do the interview. And he said, Ed Bradley has carved out 30 minutes for you up at 60 minutes. So here I am. I interviewed Dan Rather for an hour. I go up and meet Ed Bradley, and he's so gracious. He treated me like I was a reporter from the New York Times, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm asking him, who is your favorite person to interview? And he said, Lena Horne, without a doubt.
Wow.
She's the Margaret Thatcher of her time, you know? Just so great. And all because I told Dan Rather I had a problem.
You were honest.
Yeah, I was honest.
And you didn't just take it.
No.
That's awesome.
And then Tim, she calls me into the station like the next week, and she said, have you heard of Oprah Winfrey? I said,
this is your boss back at home. Yeah.
I said, no. She said, well, we're picking up her new talk show. We're one of the first stations that's going to air it. She's coming to Omaha next week at the Orpheum Theater. I want you to introduce her. So can you imagine this?
No,
this is
all happening.
And so I go to the Orpheum Theater. I'm in my little tuxedo, and Oprah comes out. It's like we're the best of friends. You know, the place goes crazy. And she said, that's my friend, Mark Pettit. We're going to take this station all the way to number one. And that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
We had Oprah Winfrey leading us in, you know, leading into the newscast.
She was doing 5 to 6?
Yeah. And Dan Rather leading us out.
Yeah.
She did 4 to 5 because we added a 5 o'clock newscast.
Yeah.
So she led into the news. We went to number one in our periods. And all of a sudden, I got an agent. I was getting, you know, calls from all over the place. And I told my agent at the time, there's only one place I want to go, and that's Atlanta. She said, it's going to happen. And so sure enough, I was the main anchor in Omaha for 2 years and got recruited to come home to Atlanta.
You're back in Georgia. And where did you land, Wagon?
Okay, in real life, I was at 11 Alive.
Yeah.
WXIA, I was the weekend anchor and investigative reporter. In the book, you know, I told you it's fictionalized in some places. So to be able to tell the story I want to tell, Mark comes to work for a station called Fearless Four.
Okay.
And it's his dream. Mm-hmm. He grew up wanting to be on Fearless Four. And so he gets recruited to Atlanta and comes here and starts breaking stories left and right, but he's miserable in his personal life.
And now, was Atlanta then the way it was perceived the last, I don't know, 3 decades or so as being a gay mecca?
No.
It wasn't.
No.
It's always been that way since I've been here.
Yeah.
I've been here since 96.
So imagine I come home in 88 to 91, my 3-year contract. No, I was in the closet. I didn't know anybody that was gay, but I was miserable. I was breaking all these stories, and I was coming home by
myself.
You had
the Democratic convention here that year?
I anchored.
You were anchoring?
That was my first weekend at the station.
Wow.
So I was living this great life, but I was in a personal prison, and I started reading Creative Loafing. You remember back in the day?
Yeah.
And the personals in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And I was drawn to men seeking men, and I would read them every week, you know? And I was just miserable. They had me, I was the number 2 anchor. I anchored every holiday, every weekend. You know what it's like?
Yeah.
They're like, well, that's your job. You want to be the main anchor someday, right?
Yeah.
You're going to work every holiday. And I did, but I was coming home and I was miserable. And I started making mistakes. And I posted an ad in Creative Loafing. Bi curious straight acting. That's what you would say back in the day, is to, not to say you were gay, you're bi curious, right?
Yeah, right.
And Tim, within a week, I had like 40 letters in my little post office box. And it was all these guys who were like me. They were like, hi, this is Steve. I work for the state of Georgia. I'm a lawyer. I can't be out. You know, and I was reading all these stories of these guys who were just like me, and I thought, this was terrible. And I agreed to finally meet one of the guys at Blake's back in the day. And
dangerous for you because you're identifiable.
Yeah. So we're sitting there having drinks, and he said, I know who you are. He said, you're taking a big risk. You know that. And I just told him, I said, I'm miserable in my personal life. And so I start seeing some guys on the side, and then it's like, come to Backstreet. You remember Backstreet? Uh-huh. Always pouring.
Right.
And I went, and I saw these guys dancing, and everybody having a great time. And I said, why am I being miserable? These guys are having fun, right? But it was incongruent.
Mm-hmm.
I could not be out and on television.
Right.
Just
then you could not.
There were no Anderson Coopers. There were no Don Lemons, you know? And so I tried to live both lives. And again, I don't want to spoil it for you or the listeners, but it all comes to a head. And I broke some really big stories at Channel 11. One was called Security for Sale. And that's where I snuck into Hartsfield and broke security twice.
Wow.
One as a pilot, one as a baggage handler. Huge news across the country. I won an Emmy for it. So I have three Emmys. And
now, these aren't local Emmys. These are national.
No, these are Southeast.
Well, and they're big deals.
They're big. This is a big deal. You can't just drive by and they toss it into your car.
You know? That's important.
It's important. I was up against Richard Belcher. You know, guys like that. Dale Russell, guys I really respect. I wasn't competing with those guys and winning. But then it comes time for my contract to get renewed, and I get called into the station, and they said, this is not going to work for us.
What's not going to work for us? Their award-winning anchor person and investigative reporter is not working for us.
This is not going to work for us. And they had security. They told me my contract was not being renewed, and I get walked out of the station.
No explanation.
Well, you didn't have to say back then.
Yeah.
It's a right-to-work state. So in the book, and again, this is a reason I wrote it as a fictionalized memoir, I've made it all make sense.
Okay.
So the story plays out, and it'll make sense when you read the book, but there's a reason Mark gets fired, and there's a reason it had to happen, because then I hit rock bottom. I've tried to warn people in my hometown. When word got out I was writing the book, and people were sending me messages, I can't wait. And I'm, well, just a heads up, this is not rainbows.
Yeah, it's very, very honest, especially getting back to that first chapter.
Yeah.
Where you were in, where was this, California?
So,
dance carefully.
Yeah, I'll step it back and say that, you know, I'd lost my job. I was absolutely at rock bottom.
Yeah.
And I had been dyeing my hair. When I started getting gray hairs when I was like 18.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I can't be gray-headed on the news. And I looked like I was at the beauty shop, where they were dyeing. And a lady she's trying to scrub the remnants off my head. And she basically said, baby, you got to quit this S-H-I-T,
you know?
And that night, I go home, and I'm just miserable. I look like Rudy Giuliani. I'm looking at myself. And I've just lost the spark. Everything's gone. And I had nothing else to be but myself. And I pick up the clippers, the shears, and I shave my head. So that's what happens when the book begins.
Right.
And I look at myself in the mirror, and I didn't know the person. I was scared of him, you know? But I write that finally he and I were free. And I didn't just come out of the closet.
Yeah. You went.
It's off the deep end.
Yeah.
So I went
into— But why not? Let's back up for a second. Let me just interject. Why not? You have been suppressing something for that long, and now you have an opportunity, whether by design or not, to be you. So you have to be the most aggressive you there is. Yeah.
So I started working out at the gym, got into good shape, and I started going to these parties around the country. They're called circuit parties. And it's drugs and sex mainly, all weekend long things. Black party in New York, but there's this party in Palm Springs called the White Party. And I'd heard about it, you know, that it was just magnificent. Everybody dresses in white. It's like you're in heaven, right? Mm-hmm. So three of my friends and I save up our money and we go to Palm Springs. And one of my friends has got us set for the week, for the weekend, drugs, everything you can imagine, pills, powders. And Mark goes to this party, and he has these little angel wings, shirtless, And he goes to this party, and he is in heaven
yeah.
the second he gets there. But then something really bad happens at the party, and you think Mark is dead
yeah.
in the first chapter of the book. And so I almost write it in a David Sedaris kind of way, where, do you know David Sedaris? Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of his writing, but I wanted it to be humorous but dark, and then with light at the end.
So I can see, having read that chapter and not wanting to spoil it, I can see how that would be a great intro for a movie.
Yes.
Or a series based yeah. on that.
So the as it ends, chapter one says, at the station we used to joke that there were three ways to get on the news. Do something great, do something stupid, or die.
Yeah.
So that's the movie starts, and just a teaser, you think Mark is dead
yeah.
in the movie. So he's narrating.
Ah, okay, okay. So that's like people who don't know who you are going to yeah. be like, what's wrong? This guy's dead.
Yeah, the guy's dead. What happens? And then he starts to tell the whole story.
Okay.
And then it comes full circle when Mark comes back in Atlanta and he enters the Silver Circle. He's back in the news business and he wins and is inducted into the Hall of Fame. And he tells people the truth.
Okay.
It's a very powerful. It just came to me in the shower. It's like, this is how it needs to be. The story needs to be told is you finally come out to your peers and they know the full story. And then everything is okay.
Yeah.
People are like, thank you for being honest. So the moral of the story is that I should have been myself from the second, but I was too young. I was too nervous. And when you get to be my age, I'm older than you are, it's the F it all mentality.
Yeah.
You know, it's a beautiful thing where you get to that point in your life where it's like, if you don't like me, I don't care, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is what it is. This is who I am.
It takes a lot of confidence to be able yeah. to be that way.
And let me tell you, Tim, when I shaved my head, I thought guys wouldn't be attracted to me.
Oh, they loved it,
I bet. Came back silver, and they were like, oh, man, yeah. hey, daddy.
Yeah.
I was shocked, and I should have let it go from the second it happened, right?
Right.
But you've heard the saying that, experience is a comb Mother Nature hands you when you're bald.
Yeah.
Right?
I've never heard that, but I like it.
Yeah. yeah. So you don't learn until you've been exposed to the lesson.
Right.
So I think it's a wonderful story. You know, the reviews have been awesome. And people who have read it, I think they're shocked when they read some of the stuff. And I say, I tried to warn you this was coming.
Yeah.
But this is the unvarnished truth.
Well, listen, if they want to be shocked, they can go read Scotty Bowers' book. Do you know?
Is that a good one?
Do you know who Scotty Bowers no. was? Scotty Bowers was a guy that worked at a gas station in L.A. who ended up being a hustler. And that gas station became a place where famous people would go to be themselves.
Isn't that crazy?
Actors, actresses.
Yes.
Charles Laughton. These old types.
And that's what these circuit parties were. They were an escape.
Yeah.
For guys and women, you know, just to go where nothing mattered, and it was fantasy. And I write in the book that these drag queens sashay by us, and I think one of them is Cher.
Uh-huh. And you say it could have been.
Yeah,
you don't
it could
know.
Have been. Because there used to be this running joke that Madonna's here.
Yeah.
And we would all go looking for Madonna, right? And I write in the book, I swear I saw her once at Warsaw in South Beach,
mm-hmm.
right? But you didn't know. They could be there. And just they're part of the crowd.
And they weren't hounded or whatever.
No.
You didn't know. So what happens, if you can say, what happens after that party? Because I don't want you to spoil the book, but do you get back into the news?
Yes.
And where? Here
so
in Atlanta?
So what happens in Atlanta, and I want to give a shout out to Mark Pimentel.
Okay.
If you haven't heard that name. I own a PR firm. It's called Creation. And it's been successful. I've had the business for 25 years. But a part of me always missed the news. Right?
Right.
And I felt like it was taken from me. It was something that it's all I wanted, and it was taken from me. And one day I go to my computer, and there's a message from Mark Pimentel. And he says, hi, Mark. You don't know me, but I used to be at Channel 2. We were competitors back in the day. I was always a fan of your work. I thought you were a great writer and a great reporter. We have an opportunity, and this was at CBS 46. I have an idea. Would you meet me for breakfast? So I go meet Mark for breakfast, and we're sitting there, and he says, we want to bring back 12 of the best ever reporters and writers in this town, and we're going to do a segment called Just a Minute. You'll have 60 seconds to say anything you want to say on television.
Wow.
I said, about any topic? And he said, yes, anything. I want there to be discourse and discussion. And I said, Mark, let me stop you right there. Don't you know my story? Because I thought, he's not going to want a gay guy
yeah.
on the news. And he says, yes, I know your story. My son is gay. It doesn't matter anymore. And Tim, I almost burst into tears at the Silver Skillet on 14th. Yeah. You know, he said, it doesn't matter anymore. You have a voice. You have a talent. We want that. And I'm thinking, it's taken 40 years,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And so he brings me back. And so I get a tip that the Supreme Court is going to rule on gay marriage. And at the time, I represented a lawyer who was an expert on constitutional law.
And this is 2015.
Yes, 2015. And he says, Anthony Kennedy is going to be the deciding. He's going to be the vote that swings it. They're going to approve gay marriage. And I was like, you're crazy. He said, mark my words. Google Gordon Schraber. So I go back and Google Gordon Schraber. As it turns out, he was a law professor for Anthony Kennedy, who was a closeted gay man. He testified for Kennedy's approval before the Senate. So it was like he owed something mm-hmm. to Gordon Schraber. And sure enough, and I went into Mark Pimentel. I said, listen, I think the Supreme Court's going to approve gay marriage. This is my very first commentary. I want to do a story. That's my first commentary. He said, go for it if you believe this is going to happen. So, Tim, this is, again, all this time I was worried about being myself. And the very first commentary, I'm going to go in and tell them they're going to approve gay marriage.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we do the segment, and I walk out, and Ben Swan at the time said, that's interesting. Do you think this is really going to happen? I said, yeah, I think it is. And I was going to Gay Pride, New York, to meet some of my friends. And I get a call from Mark. He said, there's a rumor that the Supreme Court's going to rule on Thursday. And I said, okay, look, I'll take a suit just in case
yeah.
and take it to New York. Sure enough, I have my suit and tie. He calls me and he says, it's happening. Mm-hmm. And I walk into the airport and like Wolf Blitzer, they're all around. And I look up and it says, Supreme Court approves gay marriage. And I'm like, oh my God. So Mark says, listen, can you get to CBS in New York? We're going to do a live shot back to the studio. So again, remember when I was 22 years old, I go to meet Dan Rather
yeah.
at CBS News. It's 2015. Gay marriage has just been approved by the Supreme Court. I'm back at CBS News. I step out of the Uber, and it was like deja vu. It was
right.
like so weird. They come get me. They're like, right this way. And they take me up to the studio, and they're like, okay, well, you're set for the live shot. I'm getting seated.
So this is live from
this
New York
live
down here. Okay.
On CBS, right? So it's just all surreal that this is happening, you know? And I do the live shot back to Atlanta on gay marriage, and I'm back at CBS
That's
News.
Awesome.
And that night, I have dreams that are really weird that happen during, I don't know if it's traumatic times or exciting times. And that night, I had this dream, and Dan Rather, in my dream, said, come on back. And he takes me back. I'm at CBS, and he says, you've earned this. Tonight, you're going to anchor the CBS Evening News. And in my dream, he walks me back, and we open this door, and it's like I walked into a submarine. And they get me at the desk, and I do the news for 30 minutes, and it's flawless.
Yeah.
And he said, tonight is history. Someone who earned it should be delivering it.
What a great dream.
Yeah, and it's in the book. But so Mark brought me back to doing the Just a Minute commentaries, and then that led me into acting.
Acting. So yeah. You've been doing acting now for only
2018.
Less than 9 years.
Yeah, 2018.
And what's the first thing you were in? You're in Mindhunter.
True Detective. Mindhunter.
Which season of True Detective?
Season 2.
Season 2, okay.
With Mahershala Ali.
Oh, that's
Ali.
Three. That's
season
three.
Three.
Yeah, that was a good season.
That was the very first thing I booked.
Wow. And so you're a reporter in that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I play a reporter grilling the Attorney General. And I train at a place called Drama Inc. here in Atlanta.
Okay.
And it's working actors who train younger or up-and-coming actors. And it was ironic. In class, I felt like an imposter. I'm like, I'm not an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And one night in class, Catherine Dyer, who's one of the owners, she said, you know what? We've got to break you from this newscaster thing. Actors need to be small. They need to react. Anchors project, you know? You have to own the desk, right? Mm-hmm. And so I changed my whole mindset, and we had a really emotional scene, and I almost started crying with my acting partner. And we finished the scene. She said, cut. That's it. That's acting. And from that moment on, I was like, I'm real.
Yeah.
So I as a joke, I always hashtag real actor.
Mm-hmm.
But the very first thing I booked was True Detective. And they also teach us in class that it's about eye contact. So the guy's playing the Attorney General, and I looked him dead in the eye. Mr. Attorney General. And I felt everything rose everything about the scene rose. I delivered my lines. He delivered his. I questioned him, and he walks off the stage, and it was crazy.
And you feel it in your body from the toe to the top
yes,
of your head, right?
I was electric.
That's amazing.
And Nick Pizzolatto, who's the creator of the show, comes yeah. over to me and said, that was incredible, man.
Wow.
And so then I book Mr. Mercedes.
Mr. Mercedes is a Stephen King book.
Awesome.
Great show.
Worked with Jack Bender. He yeah. was the director. And I played Anderson Cooper.
So you actually played, okay.
Yeah, the role was Anderson Cooper. So I don't know if they had Anderson lined up and he couldn't do it, but I got the part.
Right.
And one of the lead actresses, she comes over and she says, you want to run the lines? So she was so nice. So we practice and we get out there and we deliver the scene and she's giving an experimental drug to a killer.
Right.
So I say to her, so that justifies you using it to treat a serial killer? You know, and it's, the scene's great. She comes over to me afterwards. She said, that was so real. I was shaking.
Now, who is this actress?
I'll have to look up her name, but she played the doctor. If you'll look her up on IMDb, Mr. Mercedes, I hate that I can't remember her name.
I have that problem, but that's neither here nor there.
So she said, that was so real. And Jack Bender said to me, you nailed it, and you're welcome on this set anytime. Then I book Mindhunter.
Yeah, which is an awesome series.
With David Fincher.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so they didn't tell me. They told me I'd booked the part, and it's like a big secret. They wouldn't tell me what it was. I knew I was going to be an anchor. So, Tim, I get the script, and guess what the series is about?
The Atlanta bombing.
No, the Atlanta child murders.
Oh,
Wayne Williams.
Wayne Williams, that's right.
The very thing that got me into TV news, wanting to be a newscaster, they bring me back, and it's they've got the sets are built just like it's 1980.
Yeah.
I walk in, I'm like, oh my God. And he has me go into the costume department and there are all these vision boards and they had anchors from Atlanta, all the kind of suits and ties they wore. And this is in the book. They had me try on like 12 different suit combinations. They were taking pictures and I said, who's getting the photos? She said, David Fincher. He makes all decisions. So it's so ironic. So they bring me out and I'm playing an anchorman in Washington, covering the case from afar. And we do the first, I'm in two episodes. So we finished the first scene. David said, fantastic, you're getting a promotion. I was like, what?
Yeah.
He said, you're going to be Frank Reynolds in the next episode.
ABC anchor Frank Reynolds.
Who I grew up watching.
Yeah, he was my favorite when I was in the round.
He said, you're going to be Frank Reynolds.
That's awesome.
So I come back out and David's at the news desk and he's got his computer out. And I said, what's happening? She said, he's writing you more lines.
Wow.
I'm like, oh, God. You know, so this is pressure. So he and I are sitting there, and David is a very intense person. So imagine we're sitting this close, and he's like, okay, really good. Now you tell me, you're the expert. Would you say this or would you say this? So we're talking through it. All of a sudden, my chair sinks beneath me, and David says, somebody get him a chair. And we keep talking. Nobody moves. And he said, I said, get him an effing chair.
Damn.
That's intense. It's intense. So we talk it through, and we deliver the scene, and I nail it. And he comes over, and he said, that was effing awesome. That's like the real deal. You're Frank Reynolds. Mm. And I said, that's why you hired me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So getting to work with those level of people.
That's not starting from the bottom.
No.
That's getting in there.
And I said to Catherine, I said, is this normal? And she said, no, this is not normal.
Right.
She said, this is meant to be. Something's special that this is happening to you. And so, and I can't talk about it yet, but my biggest part I'm shooting on Friday.
This Friday?
This Friday, major franchise movie.
Uh-huh.
You'll recognize it when I can talk about
it. Oh, a franchise movie. So that's saying an awful lot.
Yeah.
I wonder what that could be.
And I'm on a new series on Peacock that'll be coming out this fall.
Are you allowed to talk about that one,
not,
or at least the name
yet,
of it, or
not
anything?
Yet.
All right.
If I can, I'll email you.
People probably go to your IMDb.
Go to IMDb. You might see.
Yeah. Sometimes they put that in
that there. I'm working on.
So to go from Calhoun, Georgia, being the jock, the handsome, the all American, the you know, small town boy, to you know, what happens in Palm Springs, which I want people to read, and. it's just amazing to me how far you've come. And it's, you know what, one of the things I really enjoy about doing this show on WSB is meeting people like you who are inspirational.
Well, I hope so.
No, I'm serious about this because there, you know, I do the, you know, this and that kind of interview, but 9 times out of 10, I'm choosing somebody to speak to that can help spark something in me, or I think can help spark something with people in the audience. Because we live in a time now where you can't even fathom what it was like in the 80s.
Yeah.
What it was like to be closeted and to not live your own life. Nowadays, everybody is everybody.
Yeah, and, I've joked with my friends that today you got to be gay to be on the evening news.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
So,
I'm kidding.
I'm getting messages from mothers who are writing me. They're saying, I bought your book for my son. He's gay and he's struggling.
Yeah.
And I had a woman from Austin, Texas write me and she said, he wants to be a writer like you. Would you just send him words of encouragement? I said, of course.
Isn't that great?
Yes. That means to me it's touching people.
Yeah.
And I'm getting those kind of messages that were like, even older guys, they're like, I survived it too, man. I can't wait to read this. Yeah. I read the excerpt and I can't wait. So it is touching people and that means something to me.
When you grow up in I grew up in a town that was smaller than Calhoun in Pennsylvania. And it was a college town, so there was a little bit of progressivism. But my grandparents, my one grandfather, there's the only one I ever remember saying anything about it. He was very progressive, very liberal, but not about that.
Yeah.
Not about that at all. And, you know, again, this is right in the time that you're starting to have a career. I'm in high school, and the first job I ever get, and I'm just trying to make a relatable thing here. The first job I ever get outside of high school after I worked at McDonald's for a little while was at this restaurant in our town.
I love the fries.
Oh, me too. And they made them with beef tallow then, so they were better. But I worked at this place called Marx Brothers, and one of the main cooks there was gay. And I'm 17 years old, right? And it was the best experience I could ever have because I met him. I met pretty much his life partner. And we became such good friends. And I didn't have to go through this person's, you know, all that stuff went away. And I'm just like, people are people.
Yeah, it's taken a while.
I know that's, I'm not patting myself on the back. Well, please don't think that. I'm just saying that.
It's almost once you know somebody that's gay, it changes. Everything changes.
That's what I'm trying to say.
It's when they're perceived as evil or other. You know? But Tim, in my hometown, this was a horrible thing. When this came out, people that I considered my family turned on me and my family.
Because of that.
Yeah, they wouldn't speak to my parents in the grocery store. The preacher at my church, we were wheeling my stepfather in for open heart surgery, and we look up and he's there, and I'm thinking, wow, he's come to pray with us. And he walks right by us like he doesn't even know us, didn't even stop. And my aunt said, he's no man of God.
No.
You're more of a man than he is.
Yeah.
She never forgot it till the day she died. But again, I don't want to spoil this, but something happens, COVID happens, and something really bad happens, and it brings us back together.
Okay.
People in my hometown where amends are made because of just being honest with each other, finally.
Yeah.
So there's a great message there as well, is that don't give up on your family. Don't give up on yourself when bad things happen. Because my first real boyfriend died of AIDS, and very few people know about that.
Right.
At the time, I was going through a lot. I just lost my job. He got sick, and we thought, I'm just going to take this experimental drug, you know? It was twice a day. And
AZT?
AZT. And he had to take it in the morning. He couldn't eat breakfast till 8 o'clock in the morning, and he couldn't eat at night till after 8. And I can still hear him making his little mixture in the morning, you know? And one night I came home, and he was singing Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. And I walk in, and I said, what? And he handed me a cocktail. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm dying. It's not working. And he said, they've given me 3 to 4 months, and that's it. And so, again, maybe 2 or 3 of my friends knew about this. And so to watch him go through that horrible experience, and it's in the book, was devastating, you know, to lose. I finally found somebody that I loved, and all of a sudden it was yanked too. Yeah. You know, it's like.
And so many people went through that, and no one even knows about it.
Nope.
So many people in the 80s and 90s went through that.
I think I read, David Mixner died, I think, yesterday or this week. He had said before they lost 310 friends.
Yeah.
So just imagine that in your circle, all of a sudden two guys are dead, you know, two are on your work team.
Yeah.
And it just happened so quickly. So things are better. I was lucky. I didn't get it. And now there are drugs that will hopefully keep us from getting it.
Yeah.
But back then, there was no cure.
No.
The drugs they were taking were destroying their bodies.
I read in The Band Played On when I was in 11th grade. And that was another thing that I'm like, oh, okay. Look at what happened before and look at what's happening now. And it was so weird. I was carrying it around in school. Yeah. And my English teacher, Mrs. Detweiler, she goes, I want to borrow that. And so
she probably wanted to know or
she
to
did.
Learn.
Yeah, she was great. I mean, she was very progressive.
But every family out there, you have somebody that's like me, that's more like you than you believe. Be open. And if you're a younger person out there, be yourself. It's just, that's all you have.
Yeah.
You know?
Mark, thank you.
That it? You promised me one thing.
What's that?
That Donald Trump was going to review this book, Tim.
This is the best book about an anchorman from Calhoun, Georgia, who ended up being gay.
No.
Melania loves the gays.
Melania loves it. Look, I like everybody. I mean, I think, come on, DeSantis is being a little crazy with the trans down in Florida. I mean,
he said that, by the way.
Oh, yeah. He's
very.
I think Trump is more open than you believe. All right, so can I tell you how I got the name? Because people said Anchor Boy.
Oh, yeah,
what
yeah,
is
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
So when I got the job in Omaha, I got myself a used BMW. It was hot stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm going to get a vanity license plate. So I got this license plate that says ANKRMN, Anchorman, right?
Yeah.
So I go to the prison to meet with the killer, and I guess one of the guards had mentioned it to the killer, and he says to me, what's up with the tag? And I said, ANKRMN, you know, Anchorman. Hmm. And he laughed and said, more like Anchor Boy.
And that stuck with you.
That stuck with me.
And that's where
something happens in the book that comes back. That's why the book is called Anchor Boy.
What a great.
And also,
title.
I was 22 years old.
Yeah. And you don't look a day over 30 these days.
Thank you. I'm trying.
Yeah. Good shape. There you go. You're an inspiration. Seriously, thank you for coming in and sharing your story. I hope we can talk again.
Yeah, thank you, Tim.
Because you're going to be a huge actor. And I mean, you already
are. I hope
are,
so.
But remember the little people.
I will.
All right.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Mark.